Good afternoon. This is the House Military and Veterans Affairs Committee. I would like to call the committee to order. It is now 1 p.m. on Tuesday, March 2nd, and we are sitting in the State Capitol Gruenberg Room, number 120. Present, we have Representative Nelson, Representative Rauscher, Representative Shaw, Representative Story, and myself, Chair Tuck. So let the record reflect that we have a quorum to do business. Welcome, everyone, to this committee. I really appreciate this committee and the pride that we have in recognizing our veterans and also trying to do what we can for our military families. And I would like to take this opportunity to allow members to share their experience in the military. We don't go on that long, but just for those who did serve in the military, please let us know. We'll start with you, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Chair. I would like to first pass it off to Representative Shaw, who's has a little more experience than I do. Representative Shaw.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Laddie Shaw, I'm a representative from District 26, South Anchorage, and I served 24 years in uniform, retired in 1993, two tours to Vietnam, and honored to have served. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Representative Shaw. Representative Nelson.
Thank you. So, of course, I'm speaking on my behalf as a legislator, not a part of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs or the Alaska Army National Guard. But I'm a second lieutenant currently in the Alaska Army National Guard with the 207th Aviation with the Higher Headquarters Command and the company out there. I commissioned back in 2018 through the UARTC program. And I'm a Seaburn officer, and I'm pretty excited about being here.
All right, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Anyone else serve in the military?
No, but Representative Rauscher, District 9, and we have a military base. By the way, we have all the missiles. So we got we got over there at Fort Greeley. So that's a big number in our district. It's a big number for the state. There's been a lot of work out there the last couple of years, and I appreciate being on this committee because I think that our bases are very important, and we need to be able to speak for them while we're on this committee just as much as anything else. So thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Representative Story.
Yes, thank you. I really appreciate serving on this committee this year, too. Lots of people serving in the military, obviously, and veterans in my district. Was pleased that my first bill that I passed as a legislator was helping veterans expedite getting jobs through the state of Alaska. So that is a thrill, and I'm proud that my Uncle John served at Vietnam. It's very made an impression upon me as a young teenager, and so I wanted to add that comment, and thank you.
Thank you, Representative Story. Any comments, Representative Clayman?
No, just glad to be on the committee. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you very much. And I had not served in the military either. My grandfather was in World War II, served as a Navy pilot. He was actually a test pilot for the Navy. He was actually the first Navy personnel to fly a jet. In the history of the United States. And my brother was also in the Navy. He served as during the first Middle East wars and as a photographer. He started off as an aerial photographer and a land photographer, and he had to document a lot of horrendous stuff that had happened in Kosovo and other places. And so we all, we have, Juneau has pretty good sized Coast Guard down here as well. And with Alaska having the highest percentage per capita of veterans, we all have a role, and we all have, are all impacted in some way or another with our families and our friends and our neighbors. So with that, we have two items on the agenda. We have House Bill 34, naming the Vietnam Helicopter Pilots Memorial Bridge. We also have House Bill 97 to create the Permanent Fund Dividend Land Voucher Program, the Governor's Bill. And right now, we'll start off with House Bill 34 by Representative Shaw. So Representative Shaw and his staff, Josh Walton, will come forward and introduce the bill. And then later on, we'll take invited testimony from Lynn Kyle, the president of the Alaska chapter of the Vietnam Helicopter Pilots Association. Representative Shaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Laddy Shaw represents District 26, South Anchorage. Thank you for taking the time to hear House Bill 34, entitled An Act Naming the Vietnam Helicopter Pilots Memorial Bridge. It's a topic that's very close to my heart, as I served two tours in Vietnam, and as a certified helicopter pilot, I was honored to be invited to be an associate member of the Vietnam Helicopter Pilots Association. I should note that this bill was originally the idea of Representative Kathy Tilton. She very graciously offered to have me introduce it and carry it, knowing my personal connection to the subject. I really appreciate her graciousness. I would also like to acknowledge the work of this bill done by Representative Tilton's staff, Heath Hilliard. He did the bulk of the legwork on this bill, and his work is greatly appreciated. With that, I'd like to tell you a little bit about my experience and why I'm so glad to have the opportunity to present this legislation to you. What I'd like to do is I'd like to pass around a picture that I've already okayed with Chairman Tuck. And it's 51 years old. It's a Huey helicopter that's evacuating two wounded Navy SEALs. And because of the medevac operations of this helicopter, both of those lives were saved. A little story, background about helicopter operations in Vietnam. This is a radio transmission from one of those. A salute to our helo drivers. Two helicopters flying in formation, Ghost Rider 172 and 174. Red Hat 6, this is Ghost Rider 172. I'm sorry I won't be able to help you anymore today. I've been gut shot. I have to leave you now. Hang on and good luck. The radio transmission was from the 189th Assault Helicopter Company pilot to an Army captain and his unit fighting the 66th North Vietnamese Army Regiment, 27 February 1968. Ghost Rider 172 was hit 20 times in a heavily armed area deep within enemy territory. The aircraft made a forced landing, causing moderate damage to the aircraft and two crew members wounded. The helicopter supporting Ghost Rider 172 was Ghost Rider 174. Had an engine failure and crashed 8 miles south of Ghost Rider 172. The aircraft was a total loss. Over 12,000 U.S. military helicopters spent 7.5 million hours flying over Vietnam, flying 2 million missions. A total of 5,086 choppers. About 42% of those serving Vietnam were destroyed by enemy fire, bad weather, mechanical snafus, and other bad hands war routinely deals with those sent to fight it. The toll among those who flew for a living, 2,000 pilots killed, over 2,700 crew dead. On April 18, 2018, a memorial marker was unveiled at Arlington National Cemetery just outside of Washington, D.C., to honor the young men who gave their lives flying and maintaining the helicopters flown in Vietnam. It was an event 3 years in the making. A monument measuring 22 inches high, 21 inches deep, 32 inches wide, was going to be placed at Section 35 along Memorial Drive, not far from the tomb of the unknown soldier. As a Vietnam veteran, I want to express my gratitude to the members of the Vietnam Helicopters Pilots Association for the leadership on this issue. It's been 51 years, and I still carry the anguish. For so many reasons, we need to remember the courage and selflessness of our comrades who paid the ultimate price in service to our country. And I hope
we won't take 3 years to provide this small honor. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Shaw.
Pass on to my staff, Josh Walton, to give you the specifics of this bill, if you want, don't mind.
And before we do that, Representative Shaw, do you mind sharing with us some of the elements of that picture, the photograph?
This is the UH-1 UA helicopter, which I described in my comments. And the helicopter could not land because of the underlying brush that was underneath, so he had to hover. He's evacuating two wounded Navy SEALs that got severely wounded. This operation, we lost two Navy SEALs, three wounded, two unscathed. This was September 1970. Roger Banfield was one of the wounded being evacuated. He was put in an induced coma for 8 days. His wounds were so grave. Again, I want to highlight that was September of 1970. I went back and operated the rest of my tour in Vietnam. I crossed paths with him 37 years later in New York. Very memorable experience. So it's aged and worn, sort of like me, but it's one of those memories that never let you go. And the old Hueys, you never forget the sound of the rotor blade cutting through the air, and you never forget this is being piloted by a 19-year-old high school graduate that went to Vietnam with 100 hours of flight training. And we don't really give that much thought to the perspective of Vietnam and what it was like to be 19 years old. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Shaw. I also would like to let the committee know that the gentleman in the bandana happens to be Representative Shaw. So, thank you. Mr. Walton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Josh Walton. I'm staff to Representative Laddie Shaw. I'll just speak very briefly about what the bill does. It's a very simple bill, very short. It's one paragraph long, and it takes bridges on the Glenn Highway, bridges numbers 1124 and 1889, spanning the Matanuska River northbound and southbound at mile 30.4 of the Glenn Highway, and it names those bridges the Vietnam Helicopter Pilots Memorial Bridge. In the packet that is on basis, you'll find photos of the bridge taken from Google Maps, so folks who drive between Anchorage and the Matsu Valley on the Glenn Highway, it's a bridge that you'll pass across many times. It's also, I should add, between location, the Kenai Peninsula and the Anchorage Bowl, this bridge is on the way to the Alaska Veterans Memorial, which is further north as you blanking on the name of where the memorial is. It's by Byers Lake. In the packet, we also have an academic article highlighting how the Vietnam conflict was the first American conflict to feature significant use of helicopters in and out of combat. I'm a little bit of a history buff. If you are too, then I recommend it. It's a very interesting read. I've also included a few contemporary articles highlighting the heroism of the Vietnam helicopter pilots and some of the challenges they have faced being recognized post-conflict. I'd note that the bill has the support of the Vietnam Helicopter Pilots Association Alaska chapter. President of that chapter is Lynn Kyle. I believe that he is available as invited testimony today. Let's see. And we expect that he'll be able to answer questions about exactly what the Vietnam veteran pilots experienced in Vietnam. I'd also like to note that we've received a letter from the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs Commissioner Torrance Sachs, which offers the department support for this legislation, and that should also be included in the members' packets. That's all I have. I thank you for the opportunity to present this legislation, and I remain available for questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Walton. Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, Chairman Tuck, through the chair, to either the representative or his staff. I was wondering, Is there going to be testimony, so I know how to answer the questions, whether I mean, ask good questions. Is there going to be testimony understanding the bridge itself, the and how we name bridges in the state and all that other stuff, or is it something that we could ask you yourselves? I just want to know how we may be directing the questions here.
So the naming of the bridges, I don't expect that we'll have, I should say, Josh Walton, Staff to Representative Shaw, Mr. Chairman, through the chair, Representative Rauscher. The bridges are named in statute, and so it does require legislation. It's not something that can be done by the administration absent statute.
So how are they named now? I mean, that bridge out there, mile 34, how is it denoted now?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, that bridge is bridge number 1124 and 1889, referring to the structures going northbound and southbound. And they're simply known by their numbers.
So that's something that DOT understands?
Through the chair, yes, sir.
Okay. All right. And right now there's currently no name on that bridge?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, that's correct.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Representative Nelson, and after that, Representative Clayman. Go ahead, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Representative Shaw, Representative Rauscher stole my question, but I do just want to reiterate your powerful statements. It was very moving, and I want to, as the next generation, thank you for your service and your dedicated thoughts on memorializing what you went through. Even if you are Navy and you're supporting Army Aviation, I do encourage that as much as I possibly can. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Clayman.
Just for my own geographic clarity, if I'm driving north from Anchorage, I come through the flats and the first bridge is the Knick River Bridge. Is this the second bridge as you go towards the Matsu? Or the numbers don't always mean anything to some, so describe where the bridges actually are. I assume there's one bridge going north and one bridge going south.
Through the chair, Representative Clayman, that's correct. As you're heading north from Anchorage to the Matsu Valley, you cross over the Knick River Bridge, which is, that one's previously already named, but there's another spot where you're crossing over the Matanuska River, and those bridges are unnamed. It's not as long as the large Knick River Bridge.
And it's like less than a mile after the Knick River Bridge?
Through the chair, yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Story.
Yes, thank you, Chair Tuck. Representative Story, thank you, Representative Shaw, for sharing your personal story behind the naming of this bridge. Appreciate that. I wanted to follow up and ask, how have other community members, how are they learning about the naming of this bridge so they understand the significance or know that this process is occurring?
Through the chair, Representative Story, are you asking about how this is being publicized to other members of the veteran community,
No, just the community in general and who live around that area, how they are learning about it?
Through the chair, there aren't any plans for a way to announce to folks that this is that's how the bridge is named, except for signage. There will be a sign placed, and for that reason, at least when this bill was introduced last year, there was, a $6,000 fiscal note specifically for the signs. But apart from the signs, folks will learn about it as they drive over it, is what's anticipated.
Follow-up?
Yeah, follow-up.
Also, no public comment last year on this legislation.
If I may, Representative Story, we're going to have invited testimony today and then public testimony on Thursday.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome. All right, thank you. With that, we will now turn it over to invited testimony. We have Lynn Kyle, who is president of the Vietnam Helicopter Pilot Association. Mr. Kyle, are you available and can you hear us? He dropped off the line? Okay, so what I would like to do at this time, I'm waiting for Kyle. Let's just take a quick recess, see if we can get him back on real quick. We're at recess. We have lost our testifier, or invited testimony today, so we will move on to our next bill, our next presentation, and we'll set this aside temporarily, and if he happens to call in during our committee meeting, we'll have him come back and testify. Otherwise, we'll bring him back on Thursday. Okay, with that, we now have House Bill 97, a bill to create the Permanent Fund Dividend Land Voucher Program. This is the governor's bill. We will be taking their bill presentation via the monitor behind us. We have Department of Revenue Deputy Commissioner Mike Barnhill with us. He's there on video. And he has a PowerPoint presentation that he's going to walk us through. Along with him, we have Marty Parson, Director of Division of Mining, Land, Water with DNR. But before I introduce them real quick, Mr. Barnhill, we're going to put you on hold just for a moment because we got our testifier for House Bill 34 just jumped back online with us. So we're going to take his public testimony real quick first. Thank you very much. So with that, jumping back to House Bill 34, Mr. Kyle, can you hear us all right?
Yes, I can hear you fine now. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. And please proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, and good afternoon, Committee Chair and all the committee members. I thank you very much for an opportunity like this. I'm sorry I got disconnected and couldn't get back on, but anyhow, my name is Lynn Kyle. I am a Vietnam veteran. I served 22 years in the Army, retiring right after Desert Storm. I'm also the president of the Alaska Chapter of Vietnam Helicopter Pilots. We are an all-inclusive, all-service group that includes pilots and crew members. Currently, we're about 80 strong, but we know that, according to national records, there's about 300 Vietnam pilots here in Alaska. I was going to take a little different approach today since this bill was up, and we got pretty far before the COVID intervened last year with statistics, but I will point out, Representative Shaw, thank you, sir, outstanding statistics. I'd like to add one thing to that. There's an estimated 40,000 pilots who flew in Vietnam, and medevac helicopters flew over 500,000 missions, evacuating and saving 900,000 lives at about an 82% survival rate. And what we learned there, we have brought back to the state of Alaska and to the United States, making a far greater opportunity to help those in need. Vietnam was a proving ground for helicopters, and it's an honor that those 4,800 pilots and crew did not return, but many did. These pilots and crews not only served their country, but brought their skills home to provide expertise in areas like the medical logistics, search and rescue capability. Here in Alaska, we know we are a heavy aviation state, and a large majority of the pilots were Vietnam veterans in one sense or another. Their skills have provided a significant contribution to our aviation abilities in this great state. Although they maybe didn't receive a very honorable return, their contribution and sacrifice to our nation and state is worthy of a legacy to be honored by a dedication of a small landmark in their honor. This is a historic opportunity in a great state of Alaska to honor those who have dedicated their skills to our state as well as served our country. We're losing about 138,000 Vietnam vets per year, and that is going up. In fact, our organization alone has lost four in the past year. So I appreciate all the comments I've heard, and I hope that we get favorable recognition for this small honor to a landmark and these people, and the pilots and crew members, in their honor. Thank you. I'll answer any questions if I can.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kyle. Did anybody have any questions? Okay, hearing and seeing none, thank you very much for testifying today, Mr. Kyle. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
So at this time, we're going to set House Bill 34 aside. We'll take that back up on Thursday and have public testimony. It is the chairman's intent to move the bill out of committee on that day. Okay, moving on. Going back to our friends with the governor's office, House Bill 97, to create the Permanent Fund Dividend Land Voucher Program. And here we have Deputy of Revenue, Deputy Commissioner Mike Barnhill. And along with Mike, we do have Marty Parsons, Director of Division of Mining, Land, and Water within the DNR with us. We have Anna McKinnon, Special Assistant to the Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. We have Verdi Bowen, the Veterans Affairs Administrator with the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. And Shonda O'Brien, Director of Division of Public Assistance. Mr. Barnhill, if you don't mind presenting the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mike Barnhill. I'm Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Revenue. I'm pleased to appear before the committee today to present HB 97, the Permanent Fund Dividend Land Voucher Program Bill. As Mr. Chair just indicated, I'm joined by a number of subject matter experts, depending on how the committee wants to focus its questions. The bill itself is relatively easy to understand.
Barnhill, can you hear me? You don't mind moving your camera up just a little bit? I mean, just so we have a little bit more of your eyes and get you in the picture.
Okay, hold on a sec.
We can read your lips real easy. We just couldn't see your eyes.
Yeah, it's a brave new world, isn't it?
Yeah, you still may want to move it up just a little bit so we can see your eyes. Yeah, we'll take a quick at ease and we'll get you framed in. Okay, the House Special Committee on Military and Veterans Affairs will come back to order. And Mike, if you don't mind moving back just a little bit and not lean into it, I think we'll have you have recovered really well. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And you may proceed. I'm really sorry for that.
I feel like I'm sitting in a photographer's stool and getting my picture taken. I'm no good at that either. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So HB 97 creates the Permanent Fund Dividend Land Voucher Program. And it's a relatively easy bill to understand. In addition to the array of options that permanent fund dividend applicants have today, such as click, pick, give, the UA funding program, this bill proposes to add another option that permanent fund dividend applicants can check. And here what they can check is an election to forego the cash PFD in exchange for a land voucher. And the land voucher can be used to purchase land from the Department of Natural Resources at one of their regular land sales. And what the governor has proposed here is a land voucher that the face value will be 2 times the value of the cash PFD. And it's the way the bill is structured is 2 times the value of the statutory formula of the permanent fund dividend. So regardless of what the legislature appropriates, the face value of the voucher would be 2 times the statutory formula. So for instance, if the legislature appropriates and the value of the PFD that people receive is $1,000, but the statutory formula would have produced a $2,300 PFD, the face value of the land voucher would be 2 times the $2,300 or $4,600. Mr. Chair, land vouchers have a long and deep historic precedent in this country. They were first used by Congress immediately following the American Revolution to compensate Revolutionary War veterans. Congress reprised that for veterans of the War of 1812 and the Mexican War. Various states have used land vouchers or land script to distribute land at statehood and settle the land. For those, I heard in the previous testimony, there are history buffs in the committee. There's a terrific book that came out a year or so ago by David McCullough called The Pioneers, and it details the use of land grants and land vouchers to settle the state of Ohio by American Revolutionary War veterans. Super interesting book. The overall goal of this bill, Mr. Chair, is to get more land into the more state land into the hands of Alaskans. I'll pause before I go to the next slide just to see if there are any questions about the general concept of the bill.
Any questions from committee members? Hearing and seeing none, please proceed.
Okay, so now we'll go to page 2 of the slide deck, which has some of the details. And as we indicated at the outset, there's a number of subject matter experts here, folks that have additional questions. So just going down this list of bullets, vouchers under this proposal can't be used to buy mental health trust land. This proposal does not permit children to participate in the voucher program, just adults. Vouchers can't be used to pay rent or fees for state land, only for the purchase price of state land. In order to elect a voucher, you have to use the electronic application, the electronic PFD application. You can't use a paper application. In many cases, PFD applicants are not determined eligible until after the PFD is issued. And so the bill provides that in order to maintain your eligibility for a voucher, you have to be determined eligible prior to the issuance of the PFD. And the point of that is just to help the Permanent Fund Dividend Division with logistics and not have to track the voucher program when the eligibility lags. Under this program, vouchers are transferable to anyone, and they never expire. The Department of Revenue will track any voucher transfers. So if you elect to get a voucher and you decide to sell it to your cousin, then you would bring that transfer to the Department of Revenue so we could register that and make sure that we understand that the cousin now has the land voucher. And the Department of Revenue will also replace any lost, stolen, or destroyed vouchers. Garnishment is an important program that we have in the PFD context. It's very important for our Child Support Services Division to be able to annually garnish PFDs so that we're making sure that parents are keeping up with their child support obligations. Under this bill, the amount that is able to be garnished from a cash PFD is the same as the amount that can be garnished from a land voucher PFD. And there's a variety of reasons for that. One is so that we're treating everybody the same, so whether you elect a cash PFD or a land voucher PFD, the level of garnishment is going to be the same in either case. And the other reason is that we don't have, when we transfer cash from the earnings reserve account to the permanent fund dividend account, we're not transferring cash in the amount of the total land voucher PFD, just in the amount of the appropriated PFD.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Barnhill. We do have a question. Representative Roush.
Yeah.
Thank you, through the chair, Mr. Barnhill. I was wondering, I saw there was zero fiscal notes. There were three of them. And I was wondering, how does the program operate without any cost added to the state?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, the Department of Revenue does have a positive fiscal note. It's relatively small. It covers the programming costs that we need to incur in order to modify our PFD system so that it can accommodate the voucher program. On a go-forward basis, the cost of issuing the vouchers, we think, is relatively de minimis. They're paper. And the cost of tracking them, we're going to do with an Excel spreadsheet. In the event that this becomes hugely popular, it may cost more money, but at least at the outset, we're not envisioning that this is going to be a hugely expensive program to administer.
Follow up? I'm sorry, I apologize. It is the first year, and I was wondering, there's absolutely nothing to follow every year. It's just the software just starts. It's the software to get it going, and then it happens on its own. There's no more other costs for the state at all?
No, sir, not at the scale that we anticipate, through the chair.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Clayman and Representative Nelson. Representative Clayman.
Mr. Barnhill, I have a couple of questions through the chair about the garnishment process. Just using the example, well, I'll use the example you gave. So you've got a formula for the dividend that would produce a $2,300 dividend that would get a land voucher for $4,600. But if the dividend in cash is only $1,000, what happens if the $1,000 is garnished? Does the voucher still count for $3,600 for land?
Through the chair, Representative Clayman, that's exactly correct.
Follow up? So does that effectively create an incentive for people who know they're going to have their dividends garnished, that they would apply for these land dividends and hence they'd get they'd be behind on their whatever is causing their dividend to be garnished? They would essentially get this windfall that even though they know they lose the full $1,000 cash value, they would still be left with $3,600 land value, which would differ from everybody else that weren't getting their dividends garnished.
Through the chair, Representative Clayman, I can't really speak to the incentives or lack of incentives for various people. You know, everyone's got their own motivation for taking advantage of a program or not. But the result that you describe is accurate. And so the person that had the $1,000 in garnishment would end up with a $3,600 land voucher, which they could then use to purchase land or to sell it. I should also add that we believe that the paper voucher is still subject to garnishment or attachment. But the difficulty in having the Child Support Division do that attachment is all you're then doing is giving someone a piece of paper instead of cash.
Follow up, Representative Clayman?
And then on a different area, in terms of the state land that's for sale that one could use vouchers, and let's use your $4,600 value, and let's say it's a couple because they couldn't use it for their kids, but a couple, the husband and wife, decide to use both of their vouchers to try to buy land, so I get that gets to $9,200 if I'm doing my math right. How much land in terms of state options, how many pieces of land out there today in the auctions, could anybody buy for the $9,200?
Yeah. Through the chair, I'm going to defer that question to Mr. Parsons, the director of the Natural Resources Division.
And Mr. Parsons, are you available?
Yes. Good afternoon, Chairman Tuck. This is Marty Parsons. I'm the director of the Division of Mining, Land, and Water. Going back to our records, we average about $3,000 an acre on our land sales statewide. So we normally offer 5-acre parcels, so they're around $15,000. So for a couple using both of their PFDs, they get about 2/3 of the land paid for directly from the vouchers.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Mr. Parson, any follow-up, Representative Clayman? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Mr. Barnhill, I see that it says vouchers can't be used, or that they can't apply on paper. It's only through electronic, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Nelson, that's correct.
So, and through the chair, there's still a substantial amount of people that fill out their PFD applications through just paper only. Is there a reason behind having it only of the vouchers only available to people online?
Through the chair, Representative Nelson, we've had an ongoing effort to channel as many Alaskans as possible into the electronic application process. That restriction, I believe, is also true for the Pick, Click, Give program. The only way to participate is through the electronic application. Every year, the number of paper applications declines substantially, and I believe we're at an historic low of paper applications in the state. I don't have the specific number, but luckily we have Director McKinnon online, and she can tell us what the number of paper applications was for the last filing cycle.
Thank you very much. And Ms. McKinnon, are you available, and did you hear the question?
Chairman Tuck, members of the House Military Veterans Affairs Committee, Anna McKinnon, Acting Director of the Permanent Fund Division. I just shot that note off to my ABLE team. Deputy Commissioner Barnhill accurately said that we were in the 10% neighborhood. That's what I'm recalling from the applications. 90% of Alaskans filed online this last application season, so a huge number. I can give the committee specifics, sir.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that, Ms. McKinnon. And also, if you don't mind, what prevents people some of the main reasons that prevents people from being able to file electronically?
Chairman Tuck, members of the committee, we're going to do an outreach and survey on that. What I've been told by the leadership team at the Permanent Fund Division is that typically in the Anchorage area is where we get the vast majority of paper applications coming in from. The group is heavily influenced by age. Some, it's from the rural areas, have latency issues with being able to access their internet capacity, but for the most part, our paper applications are coming in from the Fairbanks and Anchorage area in large numbers, and they're usually the senior population.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Any other questions? Representative Story.
Yes. Thank you, Representative Chuck. This is Representative Story, and I think this might be a question for another person. It's not on the PFD. Can I go ahead?
Yes, go ahead. Feel free. We have people available.
Yes. I'm trying to get a sense of where this land is available to different residents and what services, if any, are provided with this land.
I think that probably mostly directed to Mr. Parsons. Mr. Parsons, did you hear that question?
Chairman Tuck, yes, I did. Representative Story through the chair. The state runs several different land disposal programs. We have subdivision programs that are everywhere from Southeast Alaska to Western Alaska, Central Alaska, by chicken. We have our land sales all over the state, and those lands that do not sell as part of that land sale program go into what we call an over-the-counter sale, where anyone can go in, take a look at where a parcel might lie and decide if they want it. They can buy it directly online, and we also have what's known as a remote cabin staking program, where we identify a large tract of land that allows, in remote Alaska, allows people to go out, stake up to a 20-acre parcel. They lease that parcel for the first 3 years while they're getting their appraisals and surveys done, and then convert that to a land sale contract. That's kind of the long answer. The short answer is that our land disposals are statewide. Depending on the borough, where we're working will depend on what kind of amenities we and infrastructure we put into place. In some cases, a remote subdivision will have platted access but not constructed. That's obviously the case in our remote cabin staking program. And when we work within, let's say, the Matsu, Fairbanks, North Star, Kenai Borough, in most of those cases, roads will be built into, and of course, all the parcels are surveyed and staked.
Follow up,
Representative Story.
Yes, thank you for that. This is Rep Story, and I'm wondering if you can give me a sense in the Juneau area where there are some of these lands available.
Representative Story, through the chair, we haven't had very many land sales recently in the Juneau area, primarily because there's very little state land in most of southeast Alaska, since the bulk of it was not available to the state for selection as part of its entitlement due to the Tongass National Forest. We do have 400,000 acres scattered throughout southeast for community development. We have had sales around Tenneke Springs, Pelican, on Prince of Wales Island, and I think some of the older subdivisions up by the Mendenhall were originally state land sale programs.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Okay, Mr. Barnhill, would you like to proceed?
Sure. So I'm the next to last bullet point on page 2. So when someone elects a permanent fund dividend land voucher, that means they're not taking the cash, but the cash is moved for that person from the earnings reserve account to the dividend fund, and it's sitting there. Under this bill, the cash from PFD is not paid, and instead the person elected the voucher. That cash will lapse to the general fund. And then the final point on this page, this bill requires the Department of Health and Social Services and other benefit program administrators to consider the voucher as income or resources in determining eligibility for benefits programs. And Ms. O'Brien is here from the Department of Health and Social Services if there are any questions about this point.
Any questions for Ms. O'Brien or any other members? No? There are no questions? Yes, a Representative Story.
Thank you. This is, thank you, Chair Tuck. This is Rep Story. My question has to do with the fiscal note. If you said we are transferring cash for the permanent fund dividend, how can there not be a fiscal note with this?
Through the chair, Representative Story, you know, that's actually a good point. And I think maybe we should amend our note to care for that. But I'll tell you right up front, we would put an indeterminate for that amount because we just don't know how many people are going to elect the dividend land voucher in lieu of the cash dividend. But I think it's a fair point, and that's something that we can care for.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, and do we have somebody ready to go over the section analysis with us? Or have we just pretty much covered it with the bullet points?
Pretty much covered it with the bullet points. Mr. Chair, I'm turning to page 3. This was Mr. Parsons' slide, I think. Let me just defer, Mr. Chair, if that's okay, to Mr. Parsons to see if there's anything else he wants to cover on slide 3.
Mr. Parsons?
Thank you, Chair Tuck. For the record, Marty Parsons, Director of the Division of Mine and Land and Water. I think the slide is fairly self-explanatory. You know, when we look at the Alaska Constitution, I think it's the only constitution in the country that has a specific section for natural resources. And the first thing that it indicates that it's you know, our purpose to develop and to settle the land to the maximum use consent with the public interest. And we believe that the land sales is one of those ways that we fulfill that constitutional obligation. There's really no other state in the union that has less land in private hands, you know, individual hands, than what Alaska does. About 0.5% of Alaska lands are held by private individuals, where you look at the federal government, will retain about 60% of the land mass in Alaska once our entitlement has been completed. We firmly believe that the voucher bill is an excellent way for Alaskans to get Alaska lands into their hands. It provides an asset that Alaska has quite an inventory of, and reduces the strain on the state treasury, where land becomes really a form of currency. The voucher is in response to demand that we've seen. We did an informal survey monkey for Alaskans to tell us what they thought of the land sale program and where would they like to buy land. About 20% of those, close to 1,000 respondents, said that cash or cost was a significant reason for them not participating in the land sale program. So we believe this voucher provides them with an opportunity to participate. And through the whole process, we think that by getting Alaska lands into more Alaskans' hands, we can help not only settle the land, but in many cases where we're working inside of the boroughs, we can provide for an increase of the tax base.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Any questions? I have a question for anyone who could answer it. So this doesn't prevent a group of people from pulling their vouchers together and buying a larger plot of land than they normally would be able to, except for children. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, that's correct. Anybody can pull their vouchers. They can sell the vouchers to anyone they want, and they can pull them. So it's a pretty flexible program in that regard.
And for the record, that was Revenue Deputy Commissioner Mike Barnhill.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Clayman.
I'm not sure whether this is for Mr. Barnhill or somebody else, but under the current proposal, in your example, the $1,000 that would be a cash dividend would lapse into the general fund to be appropriated as the legislature sees fit. Does the department have a perspective if we were to amend this such that the cash that did not become a dividend went back into the permanent fund principle?
Through the chair, Representative Clayman, I think the logic with having it lapse is that the state is providing some additional value through the land voucher program in terms of the 2x factor, and that the general fund should be compensated in some way for that. And so that lapse is functionally that compensation.
Follow up. I'm not sure this is a question, maybe more of a comment, but if part of the goal is actually to grow the size of the permanent fund principal, wouldn't it be an incentive for those that wanted to help grow the principal, they could get a land voucher and help grow the principal if that money went into the principal? I understand it's a choice of values, I guess I'm asking. My question then becomes, would that be a decision if the legislature made it? Would that be a deal breaker from the administration's perspective, or would that be an option worth considering?
Through the chair, Representative Clayman, the point you make is a fair point, and to the extent that people in Alaska want to participate in essentially turning dollars back to the permanent fund to grow the principal, obviously that's an opportunity that could be taken here. Ultimately, it's a policy call as to where best to place those lapsing dollars. As far as whether it's a deal breaker for the administration, I do not know. But I think it's a fair policy point to make and a decent discussion to have as to the pros and cons. As I said, I think the intention here was simply to compensate the general fund for the subsidy that's built in to the sale of land here. you could take the money and put it in the permanent fund.
Any other questions? Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, just there's two remaining slides here. One is a cash flow hypothetical, which you've sort of gone through already, that tracks how the cash flows here. This particular hypothetical, I hasten to add, is based on a participation level that's purely hypothetical. It's not a projection, but here we're showing what would happen if 40,000 applicants elected the land voucher approach. And so out of you have a total of 640,000 PFD applicants here, 40,000 of whom are electing the land voucher. So the amount that moves from the earnings reserve to the permanent fund dividend fund is $1,000 times 640,000. 640 million is the total, of which 600 million would be cash PFDs, 40 million would lapse, as we've discussed, to the general fund. And then the face value of the vouchers is that 40,000 times the $4,600 per voucher, it's 184 million. And then the next part that's purely hypothetical, let's just assume that in any one particular period, $300 million of land was sold, and 184 million vouchers is tendered for that land, in addition to 116 million in cash, to get all the way there. And so when you add the 40 million in lapsing cash plus the 116 million in the cash, sales, that's a total cash to the general fund of 156 million. Again, purely hypothetical in terms of how many people participate and how much land is sold, but it just helps to see where the money is and how it's flowing. And then the last page is a mock-up of a voucher, so you can see kind of what we're thinking about issuing, what it would look like. And again, the Department of Revenue would be responsible for printing and issuing these. They'd each have a unique serial number. And then if somebody wanted to transfer or sell their voucher, they'd come to the department and register that transfer so that we could keep track of it.
And thank you very much for walking us through your slides. You may have covered this already, but let's say that, because we talked about how someone gets some money garnished, but let's say that someone only wants to use half their PFD, would it just be prorated from, would they be able to receive a land voucher for half their permanent fund dividend as prorated out?
Okay, so you're not, Mr. Chair, you're not talking about a garnishment situation. You're asking if this program will provide an option to sort of split it 50-50?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, this, Mr. Chair, this bill does not provide for that. It's all or nothing.
All or nothing unless you're being garnished.
Unless you're being garnished, correct.
Yes, so Representative Klayman.
Actually, Representative Tuck's question raises a little more curiosity about this whole proposal on garnishment. So let's say I'm a person that has, I owe $5,000 to different people, and it's, and I get every year they garnish my permanent fund. If I apply for my permanent fund and then choose to convert it to the land voucher, I get the $4,600 land voucher, but in addition, the people that would be garnishing my permanent fund still are going to be able to garnish that $1,000 and get paid the $1,000. Is that the way the statute is written as you proposed it?
So through the chair, Representative Klayman, if I'm following your hypothetical, someone elects a land voucher, they have $5,000 in pending garnishments, but under this hypothetical, there's a $1,000 cash value that caps the garnishment. So that $1,000 would go to pay off the garnishments, leaving a residual balance of $4,000 in garnishments. and then the person would have a land voucher certificate that would be reduced by $1,000. So it would say $3,600 on the face of it. The people that still are owed the residual $4,000, will have whatever legal mechanisms and tools that they have in any event to pursue that person for the remaining $4,000, including attaching the paper certificate. But let me just hasten to add, Mr. Chair, the Department of Revenue is not managing or administering that latter piece. That's up to the folks that have the obligations.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Barnhill. Follow up, Representative Clayman.
So the person that, so assuming that, stay with the same hypothetical, their 5,000 garnishment is down to 4,000. Assuming they didn't do anything to retire that debt, it would be there the next year. And the next year they could do the same thing. They could use the $1,000 cash that's garnished, that would get garnished, and in addition they'd still get another $3,600 voucher the next year that they could do with as they wish.
Through the chair, Representative Clayman, that's correct. And I think it's important to point out that person who has the residual garnishment balance, their result is the same whether the person elects the land voucher or the cash PFD.
So, follow up. So you've got this $4,600 land voucher, and we talked about how individuals could accumulate the land vouchers. Doesn't this kind of proposal create some incentive for somebody to go in and say, well, if I don't claim the PFD, I file for the PFD and I choose the land voucher. Now I've got a $4,600 voucher that can be used to purchase state land, and if I charge the cash, I'd get $1,000 on the dividend. Now I can go out and on the market, I can go find somebody that will buy my voucher for $2,000, and I sell them the voucher for $2,000. They now have a $4,600 voucher that they paid less than 50 cents on the dollar, but I just doubled my dividend. Doesn't this whole proposal that you're setting up create an incentive for people to do just that?
Through the chair, Representative Clayman, it's a super interesting question in that we don't know whether a secondary market will emerge for land vouchers or not. It seems to me that a secondary market will emerge if the underlying security, if you will, the land, is viewed to be if the program itself is viewed to have value and that folks are submitting these land vouchers and getting land for them. To me, I think, Mr. Chair, if a secondary market emerges as a result of this program, that I think in a sense demonstrates the success of it, in that the land voucher is not just a piece of paper, but in fact it has value that can ultimately be redeemed for something of equivalent or greater value. I would also say that I think the land voucher program potentially presents additional security for folks that have garnishments that they wish to execute on, in that there's additional value there. The Department of Revenue isn't administering that, but people still have, again, the legal tools and rights to execute on cash assets, real assets, in order to get satisfaction for the legal obligations. So if you've got a non-custodial parent that is accumulating paper land vouchers and does exactly what you suggested, and they've got more cash in the bank, I'm presuming that cash is available for attachment under standard legal processes.
Thank you very much. And let the record reflect that the Representative Tarr joined us approximately 5 minutes ago. Welcome, Representative Tarr. You know, one of the problems I see with this is Here we're trying to help out those that would like to buy land but just never been able to save enough money to buy land. And if you had a choice between paying your bills with your permanent fund dividend and using your voucher, if you will, or getting a voucher, used with your full PFD, I'd almost go delinquent on my bill paying. I'd let them try to get me in collections because I have a better chance underneath this garnishment provision of being able to get land in the future than I would by trying to make my bills and not being able to take advantage of the program because I have to spend part of my PFD, my permanent fund dividend. So I think we might have to work through that one just a little bit because we don't want to incentivize people not to pay their bills, knowing that they can still get a pretty valuable land voucher if their goal is to get land someday. So I just want to put that, when I look at the garnishment versus someone not being able to use their PFD other than the full value for a land voucher, I think that kind of disincentivized people to pay the bills, knowing that, again, that they'll be able to get a land voucher much easier being in collections. Am I making myself clear?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the comment, and I appreciate the concern. And of course, you know, the bottom line is what the governor is trying to do is get land into the hands of Alaskans to help those Alaskans that have difficulty in achieving self-sufficiency. And I think, you know, historically in this country, access to land and real property has been equivalent to achieving self-sufficiency. Land on which to build a house that's your own, land on which to build a business that's your own, a business that can keep you and your family sufficient. And so I think that's ultimately the goal here is trying to help Alaskans take essentially land out of a land bank the state has and put it in the hands of Alaskans so they can put it to productive use to help themselves and their families. So I hope that's responsive. I think that we all may be heading in the same direction and trying to help people through this bill.
I appreciate the intent. The intent is noble. But I guess my question would be, how is it that the department came up or the administration came up with allowing people who have garnished PFDs to still get a land voucher, but those who can only afford a portion of their PFD to not get a land voucher?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I quite follow the question. So the
let me state a couple of phrases to see if I'm correct. So currently, if somebody owes money to somebody and their permanent fund dividend is garnished, they can still get a land voucher and offset the garnishment towards the full value of the land voucher. Is that correct?
Correct.
However, if I apply for a permanent fund dividend, it's a $1,000 permanent fund dividend, but I want to withhold $500 to get caught up on my utility bills, I can't use the additional $500 to get a land voucher. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct, and I think I understand your point now. You are suggesting that we should consider a pro rata approach as well.
Since we're doing it for those who are in debt, I don't know why we wouldn't do it for those that are trying to pay their bills and not going to debt.
Mr. Chair, we'll take that under advisement. I think the primary issue with that is just logistically the ease of the difficulty in administrating that. So we'll reflect on that.
Okay, and if I may, Mr. Barnhill, would it be easier just to make it so that if anyone can't use their full PFD in any way, then they don't get a land voucher? Would that be easier?
Mr. Chair, potentially easier, but does it meet the policy objectives as fully as making it available to the maximum extent? I'm not sure that restricting the land voucher program from anyone that can have their PFD garnished is the direction the policy direction that we want to go in. So I think your proposal to make it pro rata actually potentially expands the universe of potential participants in the program, and so I think that's worthy of consideration.
Thank you very much, Barnhill. Any other further questions? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And apologies because I came late, and so you may have already covered this in your introductory remarks. But when I was studying this, I guess just going back to the purpose of this, help fulfill Alaska's constitutional mandate to develop state resources to benefit the public, make it more accessible. I'm just trying to understand, you know, what you see the benefit of this beyond that. I mean, for example, I bought land in the state program, the over-the-counter land disposal program, which is basically what this is for. There's the remote cabin program, but I did that like 15 years ago. I've owned the property for a long time. I've never built anything on it. I pay the Mat-Su Valley $65 a year in taxes for the 5 acres that I own. So I'm just trying to understand, like, say this program works and some number of Alaskans now have access to some piece of property. I study that book every year when it comes out. Most of these are not road accessible. Most of them are remote properties. Most of them are only accessible by boat or plane, including mine. And so, you know, they're remote properties, unlikely to be developed. The property, there's no state property tax. The property tax base would be local. Sure, some Alaskans might own some property, but, you know, if it's not well thought out, it could actually be disruptive to future development plans, you know, that might otherwise, you know, be a much better fit, because now you have these small parcels of private ownership, and it breaks up an area that the state might otherwise be able to do something with. So it doesn't really seem to serve a purpose that is very, like, helpful for the state, except if your only goal is you feel good if more people own a piece of property, then I guess we could accomplish that. But I don't like, there's not a lot of value in that.
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, we did cover somewhat of the history of land voucher programs, which in this country are as old as the country itself. And in programs like this, the government never imposes it, well, at least I don't think has ever imposed a particular use for the property. The uses that property can be put to are as numerous as the people that participate in the program. And the idea is that individuals can decide for themselves how best to put the property to use, how best to use for themselves and their family and their potential businesses. You know, I think the history of the country shows that land and individual ownership has been put to very productive uses in all states. And the expectation here is that once people own land, that they would put it to the whole variety of uses. As many people as there are going to be uses, and we anticipate that in many cases they would be productive uses for people and their families.
Follow up, Representative Tarr.
So it's this administration's belief there's a large number of Alaskans out there that have a lot of money, and they're standing by ready to develop a property in any number of ways if they only had $4,600 to get access to it. That seems laughable. Just for my property, it would be more than $4,600 to get just like the smallest amount of supplies to the site for building. These numbers, I just, it's like 2021, like $4,600 is, it doesn't go very far.
So through the chair, Representative Tarr, earlier in the hearing, Mr. Parsons testified as to the average cost of a parcel of land. Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to have Mr. Parsons reprise that if it's helpful to the committee.
Mr. Parsons, are you available? And have you heard the statements?
Chairman, Representative Tarr, through the chair, yes. We have land sales programs both along roads, access, like our Thousand Skies up by, on the way to Glen Ellen, right off the, Glen Highway. We've got several offerings that we've had around the Tok area. And yes, we do have some remote subdivisions and remote parcels that are available as well. The money that would be involved with this particular program would be to offset the cost of the parcel itself, not necessarily any transportation or you know, work to be done on developing the parcel. But there are land sales offerings statewide.
Okay, thank you. Follow-up, Representative Tarr?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't think we'll be able to resolve this, but you made my point exactly that $4,600 is just the land, and I guess what seems to be suggested by this bill is that there's going to be a large number of Alaskans who participate in a program, and once they just own this land, then there's going to be all sorts of development that happens on this land that's going to be good for the state. I'm suggesting that if $4,600 is what's holding this person back, that there's not any development potential. And I hope to be proved wrong. But, you know, $4,600 trying to build anything, I mean, you can't get a shed at Home Depot installed in your backyard in Anchorage for probably $4,600. So I don't know how anywhere where cost of supplies are much more expensive. I just don't think it's fair to give sort of false expectations about what could happen with this legislation.
Thank you, Representative Tarr. And we're not to final comments yet, but Representative Klayman.
I just want to follow up, go back briefly to this whole notion about a secondary market. Because after reflecting on your comments, Mr. Barnhill, I was reminded that Bitcoin, which doesn't even seem to have a paper certificate, seems to go up and down and do quite well in the current market. And it just seems to me that given the broad difference between what at least I seems to be the more likely dividend that might emerge this year and the statutory dividend and this differential in value, and you're doubling the statutory dividend value, it just seems to me highly likely that there will develop a secondary market for these. And I think that secondary market is likely to have a lot of hard to predict and potentially unanticipated consequences. One example I could see is somebody that has the resources to be able to buy a bunch of vouchers could actually accumulate quite a lot of vouchers at a substantial discount on the dollar, and then rather than give people that might otherwise lack the opportunity to get land, the opportunity to get land, all of a sudden somebody that has a lot of resources is actually using that stronger economic position to buy lots of vouchers and then ends up getting a lot of state land for what ends up being far less than they would have to otherwise, but the only people able to play in that ballpark are people that have enough wealth to be able to buy vouchers at a discount or basically buy the land vouchers at less than face value. So I would say, and that could be people that have debts, they have garnishments that they're trying to pay off, and people that are collecting garnishments. So I think there's a lot of potential unintended consequences that it doesn't sound like the department has thought through. Can you give us an example of some of the potential consequences of a secondary market for land vouchers that you all have analyzed, or are you just saying, well, that might happen, we don't know what would happen?
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, it's impossible to predict whether a secondary market will emerge or not, and what might happen in terms of fluctuating value. It does seem to me, however, to the extent that one does emerge and people are able to get additional value, even if it's a reduction on the face value, that means that they end up with more money in their pocket, more money to pay the bills, more money to pay their obligations, such as child support, that's potentially a win-win for everyone. I just don't think there's any way to say that a particular type of secondary market is going to emerge or what the value will be.
Thank you. And if while we're here, and this is the Military and Veterans Affairs Committee, I would like to ask that Mr. Bowen, if he's available, Bertie Bowen, with the Veterans Affairs Administrator with the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, to discuss how veterans benefit from Section 1.
Representative Tuck, yes, I'm on the line.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Bowen. Do you mind just sharing with us the veterans component of this of House Bill 97?
Yes, I can see a positive piece dealing with veterans simply because of the fact that once they utilize the voucher to purchase the land, they also are still eligible for the 20% discount along with that. So the land would actually become significantly less in the end once they purchase this land. And this sort of reminds me, I'm working with the Native Veteran Land Allotment that is being accomplished through the federal government as well at the same time. And a lot of those lands are located all throughout the state, and there's a significant more of that land available than there is for over-the-counter sales, but still, nonetheless, I think that land anywhere in the state is valuable to the person that's purchasing that, especially if they know their location.
And if I may, Mr. Bowen, the Native Veteran Land Allotment, is that anything to do with House Bill 97? Is there, they can use the vouchers to make those purchases as well, or is that a different?
That's a whole different issue. What that is under the Native Land Settlement Act, the federal government was unable to provide lands to those that served during the Vietnam era. And so now we have about 1,900 Vietnam era veterans that will receive federal lands around the state up to 165 acres.
Okay, thank you. Any questions while we're here? Okay, well, that's all we're going to take up today with Military and Veterans Affairs Committee. I want to thank everyone for being at our first hearing today. We're going to sit House Bill 53 aside there for a while. We'll work on, actually House Bill 97, we'll work on that a little bit further down the road. And so we will hold, we'll start having public testimony on Tuesday, March 9th for this bill. And just a reminder for the committee, the Finance Subcommittee for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs is part of this committee as well. And we will be meeting for the first time on Thursday, March 4th at 12:30 p.m. So I plan on delaying the Special Committee on Military and Veterans Affairs until after the conclusion of that Finance Subcommittee. And so for Thursday, we have House Bill 53 relating to residency requirements for public school enrollment for certain children of active duty military and National Guard members to be taken up, and we'll continue on with testimony for House Bill 34, we have public testimony. I would like to thank Tim Raymond, Tom Raymond in the back for facilitating us today, and Ariel Splitnick with House Records. If there's no other business in front of the committee, we are adjourned at 1:25.